right, what up, what up, what up? Hey, how you doing? How's everybody feeling? Good? Great? Great, okay. That's good to hear, I love that. That's fantastic news. I got my crown put back on. So I got full teeth on the left side again. Still missing the tooth on the bottom right, but, you know, I can chew a little bit better today, so that's good. Hey, you saw the thumbnail. If you're here, you're at least curious, right? I imagine these topics, I know that some of you think of this podcast as a very high-minded philosophy podcast where we discuss lots of difficult, gritty issues where I'm not always certain about how I feel about things. We're discussing important political things and things that are in the social justice space and sometimes, you know, things that have to do with emotions and the human condition. But this podcast is also just about, like, my interests. The reason why I designed it to have a different topic every week is because I'm interested in a lot of different things. That's why there's an episode where me and my dad are just talking about college football. You know, there's all kinds of things. And sometimes we gotta just do something kind of fun. And so if you're here, I commend you for at least being curious. And I guess you're already here. But I will just say, I think, look, me and Tim Blakaj today, we're talking about Batman. Obviously. But I actually think that beyond just the fact that you're going to get to listen to me nerd out, which you definitely will, there's a lot of nerding out and gushing out about not just Batman, but filmmaking, Matt Reeves as a filmmaker, Christopher Nolan as a filmmaker, Zack Snyder, you know, Tim Burton, the history of the Batman films, all of that stuff. But I think that, you know, we get into there's some interesting philosophy in this episode. We get into what makes Batman a compelling character, what makes Superman a compelling character, all this stuff. Also, what you're listening to right now, this is the audio version of this podcast. And I say audio version because, yeah, that's right. We filmed this episode, and it was the very first video version of this podcast ever. It's on YouTube right now. If you want to watch me and Tim Blakaj talk about Batman, it's on my YouTube page, which if you're not already subscribed to my YouTube, you should be. We're going video mode. I will tell you right now, it didn't go as smoothly as I had hoped for the first video episode. The reason why I had been holding off doing video episodes is because I wanted it to be real sharp and clear and cool on my nice Sony camera, and I wanted it to look real professional. Couldn't get the camera to work, but I had the live stream all scheduled and set up, and Tim was there, and so we just did it on our webcams on our respective computers from our different places, and it looks okay. What I will say is that there are two different sounds. If you listen to this version, if you choose to listen to the audio version, if you're in your car right now and this is where you like to listen to the podcast, Tim, on his end, was recording his audio into a handheld microphone, and we wound up picking up a lot of sound from that microphone. Anytime he moves the microphone in his hand, you get like a rustling of the microphone. So on this podcast version, the just audio-only version, you hear, I tried to cut out as much of it as I possibly could. I went through and edited his entire audio file and brought down the volume anywhere I could where there was the microphone noise where he wasn't also speaking. But there's still some in there when he's talking from time to time. It's not in the video version because the video version, his audio is coming directly through the live stream feed. So but it's also like he sounds like a person who's coming through on a Zoom call or something like that. So we've got a little bit more of a pure signal here on the podcast version and a little bit more of like a Zoom call version of audio on the video version. So there's two versions of the show. But right, what's not on the video version is this, what you're listening to right now, this intro. This is audio only. So that's kind of a fun thing that I think we're going to keep as we do the video version of the podcast is the audio version will still have like the intro, outro, and the music and all that stuff. So experimenting with it, figuring it out. But yeah, I do think that this wound up being an interesting conversation about cinema, about storytelling, about what makes certain characters so compelling. Why do we keep seeing these characters, these archetypes coming up and being reinvented and you know? So I think that even if you're not a huge Batman fan, there's something in here potentially for you to sink your teeth into, something in here for you to go, maybe that's why, because maybe you're going, what is it? Why are people so obsessed with this stupid character? And that's what we're trying to get to the bottom of. So I hope you enjoy it. Yeah. Here we go. Let's do it. Let's get to the show. I think this is it.
Sounds good.
I think this is it.
This is it.
Holy shit.
Live, seconds live, 8 seconds, here we go.
It's the first ever video version of People Pleaser with Austin Archer live on YouTube. Everett was here a while ago. I don't think he stayed. He was here at 1 o'clock when we were supposed to start. I don't know if anyone will watch this because it's my first time ever doing it. I didn't announce that I was doing it because I sort of anticipated the technical difficulties.
Yeah.
I'm not confident. I'm not confident that I'm going to be able to nail it.
I get that.
Right out of the gate. Everett's back. Everett's back. Love it. But I figured I would give it at least like a rough shot for the first ever video version of the podcast. But this is, I mean, I tried to do it on my nice Sony camera. I went out and I got a little a video capture card device, a little Cam Link, and like this the HDMI cable that I needed, and I downloaded the software that I needed, and everything looked like it was working, and then it just didn't work. So I'm using my front-facing camera on my laptop for this first episode of the video version of the podcast. But this is episode 113 of People Pleaser with Austin Archer, from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. This is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer. I'm talking today with Tim Blakage, the comedian of cinema, about Batman. We're talking about Batman. How you doing, Tim?
I'm doing all right, man. What's going on? I didn't know this was the first video of yours.
This is the first. So I've been posting videos to YouTube, but this is the first
video podcast. Yeah.
Video podcast.
Yeah.
Ever. And I've been wanting to do it, and I've been meaning to do it, but I wanted to do it right. I wanted to have like nice cameras. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have it looking good. And I thought I was ready, and I wasn't ready, but it's okay. It's okay. Maybe it's better to sort of tiptoe into it this way, and then things will ramp up from here.
I get that.
I think I should say on the outset here, spoiler effect in war.
Oh yeah. Major
is in effect. Spoiler warning is in effect. Did I say spoiler effect in
spoiler
warning?
Spoiler effect in warning.
Spoiler warning is in effect. We're going to be talking about the new movie by Matt Reeves, The Batman, as well as other Batman movies. So like any Batman movie that you haven't seen, we could discuss here. And it'll all be on the table. I sort of want to work backwards because there's a lot we have to get through.
Mm-hmm.
In not a huge amount of time, but I want to start with some just opening thoughts on this new film. How not disappointed are we in Matt Reeves' work on this movie?
I remember hearing that Matt Reeves had gotten the job, and it was like really tentative in like 2017, summer of 2017. And I was like, he makes really good movies. I really like his horror remake of Let Me In. I think it's better than the original, which never fucking happens when it comes to remakes, especially horror remakes. I really loved Dawn and War for the Planet of the Apes. I really loved all his other work. And at that moment, I was like, all right, expectations are up there. Like, not to a point where I could disappoint myself, but I was like, this guy's going to bring something. And then, you know, over the time, he's like teased the 60s Batman inspiration and all those things. And I was like, this is like, he's going to do something completely different. And I'm excited for that. And then after finishing the movie, I brought my uncle. My uncle he got me into comics and movies and all that kind of stuff. And I just looked at him like, because he's very tentative when it comes to this stuff. He's especially Batman stuff. He's very, you know, it's got to be either one, like, great or, you know. And I just looked at him, and I was like, this is something else. This is just, it's that's what it is. It's something else entirely. And I've seen it four times now, and I might
four times.
Yeah, and I might see it again tonight because I'm up in Yonkers and they have an Alamo up here, and I have nothing to do. I could just go and check it out. But yeah, no, I love this movie. I love every bit of this movie.
I've seen it twice, and I'm definitely going for round three. I don't know if I'll make it to four before it leaves the theaters. I might make it to four, but I'm definitely going for round three. I haven't seen IMAX yet, and I want to see IMAX.
That's the one. I only see, like, the blockbuster ones in IMAX. Everything else, I go to smaller theaters or, you know, just to, like, you know, sometimes IMAX doesn't, I mean, AMC, which, like, where's all the IMAX theaters are, they don't show, like, the small movies, or not even just small movies, like Tragedy of Macbeth wasn't playing at an AMC theater near me at all, which makes no sense. But yeah, I saw, like, you know, The Matrix, Spider-Man, and Batman so far, and Eternals at an IMAX theater, and that's the first one. That's the one I was like, this is the screen to watch something like this on, a giant, giant fucking screen.
Yeah, there were just no good seats left when I was going on Thursday night. They were all taken, and I was like, well, I got to go see it. I can't wait a moment longer. So I just went to one of the normal theaters, and then I thought, I'll go try to find an IMAX showing for later that weekend. And it was still totally full. So I was like, I'm not going to sit in the first three rows of an IMAX theater. I just won't do it. There's no point. It's like, I've done it before.
Yeah, no,
like,
it's impossible.
You can't see the movie. You're just like, okay, I'm seeing, like, the bottom quarter of the screen.
It comes to a point, even, like, I stayed up, like, until, you know, the time that the moment they put tickets on sale, because I was like, I don't even know how many people I can bring with me. I'm just going to get five tickets in a row, far from the front. And every time, even, like, when they sell it, there's always, like, the first three rows of an IMAX that never get sold, because who wants to sit in those seats? You can't enjoy anything that way.
I don't know why they even exist.
Yeah.
I have a friend who really likes sitting close in movie theaters. He's one of the first people I've ever met who really likes it. And I don't know if he likes sitting that close in IMAX theaters, but he likes to sit in the front section. And if we will allow, he likes to sit, like, almost on the front row. He likes to be, like, he wants his whole field of vision to be the screen. He doesn't want to see anything else. But I'm like, for me, when I'm that close, it distorts the image.
You're looking up. You have to go like this. Everything is kind of spread. It's not.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's not the way that I think it was intended. Because I feel like for most movie theaters, like, first, second row is too close. But in IMAX, for sure. Okay, yeah. So I had the same experience. I feel like people don't know, and they still don't know, really, like, who Matt Reeves is, and they're about to, like, more and more and more, they're about to. It's very similar to what happened with Christopher Nolan, where, like, people were aware of Memento, people were aware of Insomnia, people were aware, like, people, film buffs and the film aficionados were, like, following his work. But when Batman Begins happened, the general population didn't know who Christopher Nolan was.
No.
And it was a very big coming out party for him, and, like, a very, very big announcement. You'd think that more people would know who Matt Reeves is, because he hasn't been making, like, small indies.
No.
He made two huge blockbusters in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War for the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing about that trilogy is it was somehow, like, kind of a sleeper trilogy. Like, a big budget, expensive trilogy. And a lot of people didn't see those movies. Like, a lot of... I talk to people all the time that I'm did you see the Planet of the Apes trilogy that came out a few years ago? And they're always like, no, I've heard that it's good. I'm like, it's...
It's one of the best, like, recent trilogies ever.
It's spectacular.
It's incredible.
And it's got a decent first movie.
Yeah.
The first movie is almost completely undone by James Franco's performance, because he's just garbage. And I can't remember who directed the first movie, but Matt Reeves didn't direct it. But the movie's good enough, and I think the first movie, like, surprised audiences and critics. It was
because,
like,
it's a fair start to the trilogy, you know.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I remember seeing it and being like, oh, that was better than I ever thought it could be.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot better than I thought it should have been. And Andy Serkis's work is the thing that sort of anchors the film.
Yeah.
And, like, you're like, okay, Andy Serkis as Caesar in that first movie, he's very, very watchable and very compelling. And the animation is, like, really great, like, really, really great right from the jump. From the first movie, the animation is, like, really impressive.
Yeah.
Next level stuff. And the storytelling is, like, pretty solid. James Franco just sucks. And then the second movie happens, and we're in a whole other universe of quality. Like, it's just right from the jump, right from the opening scene of the second movie, you're like, oh, this is like a good movie. Mm-hmm. This movie's like gonna make me cry. Like, yeah. The animation is as good as it is in the first movie.
Well, they reinvented the tech too.
Yeah.
In between one and two, they completely reinvented like motion capture and CGI capture and all that stuff. And
the opening shot of Caesar's face in the woods, and it's just his eyes, and it's so slowly good. Pulling back from, and it's just like, what am I looking at? So often in that movie, you're like, I can't believe this is animation that a human did on a computer. Like,
yeah.
And knowing how solid the actors' performances are that inform the animation, because it's not just Serkis that does great work. It's like the guy who plays Koba does amazing.
Yeah,
work.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's another one. He's just not, he doesn't have the acclaim of Serkis. And even then, when you think about it, like the amount of like parts or aspects of filmmaking that go completely unnoticed, that it takes so many people to like execute.
Yeah.
And Serkis is on top of that list. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah,
it's incredible.
Well, and he's just doing, I mean, he's sort of the guy who kind of pioneered this, mm-hmm. this form of acting. And there's a lot of people who have done it now with the Avatar movies. And we just see it all the time now with Josh Brolin as Thanos and things like that, but Andy Serkis is sort of like the OG, the top dog, and he still continues to find ways to be the one who just stands out amongst the crowd of like the best actors in the world at doing it for some reason. He's so amazing with his face and so expressive, and the subtlety of his performance as Caesar in Dawn and War is incredible. In fact, in all three movies, like humanity and the journey that the character goes on, the growth of the character, it's just incredible. And so my expectations were sky high when I heard. I remember being disappointed, like a lot of fans were, that Ben Affleck wasn't going to be directing his mm-hmm. own Batman outing, because I did like the Ben Affleck interpretation of the character. But when I heard Matt Reeves was doing it, I was like, oh, well, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
This is going to be fantastic.
For sure.
And I had absolute faith in him. And I kept telling people that the whole lead up to it. I was like, oh, well, Matt Reeves is great. And people were like, who's that? I'm like, he's the guy that directed it. And they're like, I don't know who that is. I'm like, oh, well,
he's very
you're
good.
About to know. to know who he is. Yeah. And with sky high expectations, I was not disappointed in the slightest by this movie. I feel like it exceeded my expectations, and I just loved every frame of it. From start to finish. A filmmaker who knows how to put the audience at ease. That from the jump, when it's silent with the Warner Brothers logo and DC, and then intro to Ave Maria as the full screen text of the Batman hits the screen, and it looks just like a graphic novel. It looks just like a Frank Miller graphic novel. You're just like, oh my God, we're in good hands. Like, we are. Yeah.
It's unreal.
It's so, like you said, you turned to your uncle and said, this is something else. This is something different. It's so interesting that this one feels the most like a comic book of any of the Batman movies, I think, so far. This feels the most like a graphic novel.
I think that's because it had something else to do. I think the most of these, or at least maybe in the last decade and a half of comic book movies, it's very singular. It's like the storyline is very like there'll be a B plot or something, but it's never something that affects anything at all. And in this one, it had like three different stories to kind of unravel, and it connected them all, and it happened in a way that we haven't seen. Also, like it's its own. That's why I say like there are very few filmmakers and comic book movies that have hopped the genre of comic book movie. Because when you think of a superhero movie or something, you think of the Avengers and you think of a Batman or Spider-Man or whatever, and that's like its own lane. And then there's a brick wall in between that and the rest of all other movies,
right?
That very few of these actually get to hop into. And I think that's what happened with this one, because there's a whole other, the way to tell the story was completely different, but it also leaned into the comic book. Like I said, I put a bunch of tweets about it. Like, it felt like I was reading a graphic novel.
Yeah.
It felt like I had a thick compendium of a bunch of issues, and I just went through it and an interesting story and great performances. And like, you know what's funny? My favorite thing about people talking about the movie is the only things people are like talking about are things that you can't objectively say are bad, because it looks amazing. It sounds amazing. The performances are amazing. The writing is amazing. The only thing people can be like is like, I don't like how this looks a little here. This doesn't make sense to me. And it's like that. You can't really dispute, because people are always going to have their own tiny things about something.
There's always going to be things you need to suspend your disbelief for. You made a tweet the other day that I was like, yeah, that's right on. Where it's like, if you are cool with Christian Bale skydiving out of a penthouse and landing on top of a car, which I've never really understood that moment. I'm like, how is he? What is he? Sort of deploying his cape.
It's and supposed the cape to be slowing sort of, him down or some bullshit.
The cape is sort of slowing the fall down, and then he turns his back and lets Rachel land on him. But I'm like, yeah, but you're still landing like you with the full force of your body on a car. And like even like the shot in The Dark Knight where he jumps off and lands on the van. Yeah. And he just sort of does a free fall and just lands feet first.
His knees
on the
are mashed like, potatoes.
Yeah, and I'm like, what? You know, but you go with it.
You let it go because there's a guy in a bat suit jumping around. Like, it's fine.
Right, right. So, like, and that's the thing of when you're talking about jumping genre, because The Dark Knight did it as well. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that makes it hard to jump genre are those things, are those elements. If you're going to try to pull it into the world of, like, actual cinematic storytelling, where, you know, and Christopher Nolan calls it a cinematic reality, that he's like, we want it grounded in reality, but a cinematic reality. And in this cinematic reality, while Bruce Wayne, Batman, is just a man who is aided by tech and, you know, top of the line equipment, there's still an aspect of him that does seem superhuman.
Yeah.
There's still and there has to be. There's an aspect of Batman always in the comics too, that even though he's got bulletproof armor on and he's got all the gadgets and gizmos in the world and a really cool car and he's the best fighter in the world and he's got a great brain, there's still an aspect of him that it's like, even a great fighter with great armor and great equipment shouldn't be able to take this much.
Yeah.
Punishment. He's able to take more than a normal person would be able to take. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the character where it's like he's got a different gear or a different kind of pain tolerance. Like, he's got a different ability to like work through. And you just have to sort of go with it. You just sort of have to go like, I mean, Robert Pattinson getting clipped on that squirrel dive and hitting a bus, like, dead. You're dead.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care what you're wearing. You're dead. Or you're, like, paralyzed and all your bones are broken. Mm-hmm. And you're definitely not getting up and getting right back to work.
Yeah, it's like,
which is what he does. Getting up, shaking it off, and getting right back to work. But I'll go with it.
Yeah.
What the movie is showing me in the comic book reality, the comic book cinematic reality, is, like, this guy is still working out the kinks of being Batman.
Exactly.
Very much
so. Oh, my God. And what better filmmaker to tell this story and then the next one than Matt Reeves, who has, like, perfected the time jump with the Apes movies? Like, I'm 100% expecting the next one, because there's going to be a next one. It made $500 million in, you know, 2 weeks or a week and a half or whatever.
Yeah.
I 100% expect, like, he's going to learn from the fire extinguishers. He's gonna have smoke pellets. He's gonna have batarangs because he needs something to project so that way he doesn't have to shock himself again. You know what I mean? Like, he's gonna learn from these experiences. The gliding is gonna be, he's gonna have to master that, because clearly, like, he's never gone up to a height of that at that point. The way he kind of shudders at getting that high and he still goes through with it. It's like, it's funny to keep reinforcing it, but like, this is year two. There's a lot of things he hasn't had to do yet that he's going to figure out now.
It's one of my favorite things about the movie is how messy Batman is.
Mm-hmm.
How when he gets in fights, he gets hit and he gets knocked back and he finds himself in situations where maybe he got him, like, from the jump, from the opening fight scene, he doesn't just dispatch those guys without getting a nick. They get their licks in.
Yeah.
Like, they get a few hits in, but he just, again, it's that extra level that he has access to where he's like, I'm not losing a fight. I'm not losing a fight to a bunch of street thugs. Like, I'm going to figure out a way to beat these guys. Even if, you know, they're getting their punches in and their jabs in, like, he doesn't go down. And I also love the fucking club scene. Like, the club scene is, like, one of the coolest Batman scenes I've ever seen in a movie. And I've always wanted to see this since I was in college. I've always wanted to see a Batman who just walks up to people.
Yeah.
Who doesn't appear, you know, like, and I like that about Bale's Batman, that he always appears and disappears. And they do a little bit of that in this Matt Reeves movie. They mm-hmm. have stuff where he disappears, and appears. But I've always wanted to see like from the entrance, hearing the heavy boots and having him just approach and just walk up, and then going up to the club, knocking on the door and going, "Hey, do you know who I am?" Mm-hmm. And just like, "I'm coming in."
It shows in. So you know? Much of the headspace of this particular Bruce Wayne. Like, one, we like, by the end of the movie, we learned that like his vengeance means nothing. Like, it only inspires, you know, violence, and it doesn't. It's not what the city needs. Basically, you don't need someone going around and enacting vengeance that most people don't have to deal don't have anything to do with. Like, he's just, you know, it makes no sense. And there's an aspect to Batman that's like, that's what he does, is vengeance, but he's kind of missing the cap on that in this version of him. And I love the idea that not only does he want to enact vengeance in such a brutal way, he doesn't go into that, like, he's got a death wish. He doesn't put himself in the opportunity to dodge bullets or to, because he probably can work on that if he wants to, but he's got a whole fucking seeing red thing going on, you know? He walks into fights because he knows it's more effective, like, visually. And he tells people, like, I imagine for the last 2 years before the movie starts, he told many, many people that he beat the shit out of I'm Vengeance, which is why everyone calls him Vengeance when they see him. And I read a review that was really interesting, and he said, this movie will make you get tired of hearing the word vengeance. And it's like, that's kind of the point. In that, like, it's a silly undertaking to just go around and, like, I'm going to enact, like, I wonder why I don't have an effect. I'm beating the shit out of everybody. It doesn't make sense. And the end of the movie, he learns that effect inspired this insanity with the Riddler and the Riddler's, you know, incel cronies. And he learns that rather than vengeance, he can, by doing less, he can achieve more, you know, by just appearing sometimes. Like, I 100% see him evolving just like that physically. Like, the character is going to do those kinds of disappears and showing up without having to make such a ruckus. Like, he knows he doesn't have to do that anymore.
Well, and Reeves is such a smart filmmaker and such a good visual storyteller to start the movie by showing basically Batman and the Riddler doing the exact same thing. Basically just stalking prey from a distance, moving in from the shadows, and then attacking. And one is just slightly more violent than the other. Like, just slightly. One is just, like, slightly more homicidal than the other. Mm-hmm. And seems to enjoy it a little bit more. You know, but, like, other than that, it's just two guys in a costume, stalking prey from a distance, moving in from the shadows. And he does that throughout the movie, shows their similarities. But he does it in a way that doesn't feel super heavy-handed. I think the first time that I really noticed it was when they had Bruce outside of Selina's apartment.
Yeah.
Looking at her and I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. And I'm like, because my first thought was, oh, is the Riddler outside? And then I'm like, oh, no, it's Bruce.
They're the only two we have that point of view of, yeah.
Yeah. But there's so many visual storytelling moments that Matt Reeves does so wonderfully. There's so much shown that doesn't need to be discussed. Thank God we don't get a flashback scene of Bruce as a little boy watching his parents get shot and his mom's pearl necklace being snatched off of her or whatever. You know, like, all it takes is Bruce walking by that little kid's room and looking into the room and just looking at the little kid.
And we all know.
We know exactly what's going on. And that's all that needs to be done. And it's, like, perfect and poetic and beautiful and, yeah, just really, really cool visual storytelling throughout the movie. Showing Bruce putting on his shirt after his first night out, and you see all the scars and stuff, and you see all the, and it's just, and that's all it needs to be, you know, like, doesn't need to be mentioned, doesn't need to be talked about, you know. And then, I mean, something we can talk about too is, like, the humor in this movie. People talk about how it's such a humorless movie and how it's not funny and how, like, and first of all, like, no movie owes you laughs. Like, people have this idea that if it's a comic book movie, it needs to be funny. First of all, watch the trailer for the movie. Like, did you get a sense for, look at a poster for the movie. Did you get a sense for the tone of what this movie is? Like, to expect that the movie would make you laugh at all is probably a little bit of an unreasonable expectation, but it is funny. And I think like the first big joke that got me chuckling was like him putting on his sunglasses in the morning when he comes out and the sunlight is in the room and Alfred's like doing the, you know, and he puts his sunglasses on. Like, I'm like, that's a funny little visual beat of him just being like, I don't do the sun, you know?
I would have loved to see that meeting with the accountants. That would have been hilarious. Just there just kind of like not really paying attention or not really giving a shit. And Alfred just trying to like play everything along.
I'm kind of glad that we didn't see it though.
Yeah, no, I know. The fact that it's all implied, like, that's not the, like, we're so in Bruce's head that is nowhere near important enough to actually be seen.
Well, and Reeves is so judicious with the time. Mm-hmm. It's a 3-hour long movie and he uses every second of it. And so he doesn't want anything to be in the movie that is not the next thing that leads us to the next place. Mm-hmm. There is no wasted scene in the movie. So a scene with him and the accountants would have been funny. It would have been fun.
Yeah,
to
no,
see
exactly.
That.
That's just,
but it doesn't lead, if it doesn't lead us to the next event, it can't be in the movie. Mm-hmm. We can just hear that, you know? And so like the next scene we see is like Alfred figuring out the cipher and then Bruce going, oh, what if those were the only symbols? And then let's punch that in. That leads us to the garage where we get to the car, we get to thumb drive that, which is another great, joke. And everything just leads to the next place. Every clue is like, oh, well, we got to go here. And then when you realize that the movie takes place over a 7-day span, it's just a week long, you're like, oh, so really it's just boom, 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 7 nights in a row.
Yeah.
And it really is like the long Halloween. It really is this, you know, week-long event that the Riddler has planned. And that's another thing that you have to suspend disbelief for, because it's kind of like, man, he's getting his ass kicked every night and he's going back out. But that's another thing that makes him him.
Yeah, that's like the iron will of Batman is still there. You know, he can get shot in the chest. And even like Selina is on him like, it's okay, everything's okay. He's still trying to get up and he just took like both barrels of a shotgun in the chest, you know?
Yeah, people have talked about that as a detraction from this movie, that he seems to be the most bulletproof Batman that we've ever gotten, that he gets shot more than anyone else. And I'm like, yeah, well, he is. But he also has like the most heavily armored suit we've ever seen.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's like clearly like a tactical like SWAT suit. I mean, the belt, I think there's a close up on his belt at some point, and it's an exact SWAT team, like SWAT officer belt. And like he's clearly put time and energy into making sure he's bulletproof, because this is not going to be a place where, you know, they all attack him one at a time and they all have like crowbars or something. It's a real danger that he's going into.
He's probably even had Alfred like shoot him with different guns while he's wearing things and been like, I need to see what it feels like so that I can like know how to stand up when someone shoots me. You know, I need to be able to like stand there and take it and like look at someone in the eyes when they shoot me 3 times and I don't move, you know, like get used to the feeling of that and train my body to, you know, I like how messy he fights. I like how many pickles he finds himself in, that he finds himself in situations where he's just like, oh shit, like, you know, getting like blown up and finding himself in the police station and being like, I gotta get at it, you know. And it's cool to see him sort of fumble around through it, but still be Batman, still be undeniably like the smartest guy in the room, the bravest guy in the room, you know. The audacity to just like walk up to people and be like,
like headstrong and so just, that's what I mean. Like by Death Wish, like he truly doesn't give a shit. It's all about the mission. And, and then I just love the idea that he finds out the mission was kind of misguided it led to like some real unsavory shit.
Yeah. What'd you think about Paul Dano? Do you feel like the movie could have used more of the Riddler, or do you feel like it's the right amount?
I think for a 3-hour, you know, graphic novel, I don't want to see more of him, because I'm obsessed with how he's used in this.
Yeah.
I love that he's there teasing everything along, and then he just sits back while Bruce basically kind of figures out everything. And But that's the type of villain he is. He's in that third tier of villain that is the one you deal with last.
Well, and it's smart. It's smart to know that about that character because it's not the same as the Joker, where like, you know, the Dark Knight is like Heath Ledger's movie, and we as the audience want him on screen as much as we can get him. Like,
exactly.
Just like we want that guy in as many scenes as we can possibly get him in. He's so compelling to watch. He's driving the plot forward. He's the like he's kind of the person who's moving events forward, and we want to be with him as often as possible. With the Riddler, it works better if he's shrouded in mystery.
If he's a puppet master. That,
and if it feels like Seven was a very good blueprint for this
movie. That's a perfect example.
Yeah. It was a very good, and they did. They talked about early on how they were basing it off of that movie and looking at the David Fincher crime thrillers like Seven and Zodiac.
Seven,
and
Casino, Zodiac, all those like just those movies that tease you out throughout the entire movie until the last, you know, 20 half hour is absolute insanity.
Yeah. In Seven, you get those like few, fleeting glimpses of John Doe, like where they almost catch him at his apartment mm-hmm. in that one scene. He walks up to Brad Pitt and puts his gun up to his temple in the rain, you know, and then like walks away.
Mm-hmm.
Great scene, but you don't get him to the very end, and you could think like, oh, Kevin Spacey's so great in that movie, it would be great to see more of that character, but it's also like great that he's used so judiciously
mm-hmm.
and that very much feels like what they wanted to do with Paul Dano is just sort of like tease him out over the movie and make a big meal out of the reveal of his face. I did feel like a little bit like when the trailers were doing that where they like weren't showing us his face, I was like, it's going to be Paul Dano though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's Paul Dano. And that is, so I want to say this. If I have any criticism of the movie, and this isn't even a criticism of the film because it's not about the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about just like Hollywood today. And I'm usually not this guy. Usually I have a lot of friends who criticize trailers a lot mm-hmm. and who are like, trailers are getting out of control. They're just showing us the entire movie. And I'm always like, it's 2 minutes of a 2.5 hour long movie. Like, you're not seeing the whole movie. I was pretty bummed out watching this movie being like, oh, every single action sequence is in the trailer. Every single one.
Yeah.
There wasn't a single action sequence that wasn't represented in the trailer. And I was like sort of hoping that there would be a couple that would be like a surprise, that there would be a couple. But I was like, every single one of these cool sequences, every coolest shot in the movie is in the trailer. Like the Batmobile coming through the flames, even him like clipping his belt to the side of that building that's under construction and running down the building. I'm like, man, that could have been something that you save. Like that, we didn't need that in the trailer. I just felt like Warner Brothers and the PR team went a little overboard with the PR on this movie. And like when they started just posting scenes constantly on YouTube.
Oh,
I was
yeah,
like,
no.
Enough. I was like, knock it off.
I
don't want to, like, because it's also like, guys, do you not think people are going to go see this movie?
Mm-hmm.
Are you really concerned that people aren't going to buy tickets for the Batman? Like,
I
think it's a lock. Like, but to me,
I get that. I think that what's interesting to me is there's always, I've always been like, can't stand the incentivization most of the time of whether it's like a movie like The Batman or, you know, like the next season of a show being like, you're not going to believe what happens next. I'm like, hey man, like this isn't the 50s where you had to have those interludes between like what'll happen next on fucking the Honeymooners or whatever. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't, that's not needed. Like when you haven't, I mean, I guess it's come to that point where you have a name like, you know, Spider-Man or Batman or whatever, and you kind of have to incent, like you have to give people like, oh guys, trust me, you're gonna want to come next time. But yeah, I when it comes to the trailer, I've watched the first two and I was like, that's it, nothing. I don't, even if like for any other movie they release, you know, 30 second scenes or a minute scenes, and like if they do a talk show or something, I avoid them because I'm also like super vocal about this on my page. Like if you get spoiled by something, it's on you. If I am going around, if I haven't seen Batman yet, and I'm going on the internet, if I'm going on Instagram, Twitter, whatever, it's my fault if I see something or hear something or read something. So it's 100% like I put in the effort to not watch, you know, the clip where the car burst through the funeral scene.
Yeah.
Because I was like, nope, yeah. nope, not going to watch it because I want to experience that in a theater. I am totally ready to watch like the panic rising and everyone else freaking out, but Bruce is analyzing it. Like, I don't want to have that aspect of the movie ruined for me. And
that first trailer that came out like a year and a half ago, like it's been a long time since that. Like,
oh yeah, that was 2020 of DC fandom.
Yeah.
Jesus.
That was just enough for me. That yeah. was like, and it was such a cool trailer. And
well, they also had only shot up to that point too, because yeah, of the fucking
and
pandemic.
But it was fucking good. Like yeah. it was that sound of ripping of the tape coming out. And like, and the way that right off the bat, again, Matt Reeves, like letting people know, like, you're in good hands. This is going to be dope. And right off the bat and that, you know, and then, but like, if I had only seen that, I'm like, I'm in on this movie 100%. And then as the second and third trailers came out and I watched both of them, I was like, it looks amazing. It looks so awesome. But I remember feeling like, they're showing me a lot. Like they're showing me a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, yeah, but it's a long movie. And obviously, like, I still loved the movie, but I was a little bit like, and this was only my first time watching it. I was like, I wish some of this stuff I hadn't seen mm-hmm. before and was a little bit more of a surprise to me. And then my second time watching it, I just got to really enjoy it yeah. and really like marvel at the fight choreography and the smart choices made from a filmmaking standpoint. And so it didn't bother me as much. Because at that point, it's like I already knew the movie too, so I was yeah. just watching for extra detail and stuff like that. But
well, part of the way I think about it is like it'll never be what it is when it's clean. You know what I mean? When you're watching it for that first time, and if a sequence shows up that was in the trailer, like the whole joke was like the majority of the car chase was in the trailer, and it's like, all right, well, I'm gonna show you the 5-minute car chase, and I'll show you the intercut of scenes that they included from the car chase, and we'll tell me which one you would rather watch in space of like that point of the movie. You know what I mean? There's always going to be that level of watching it in a clean pass rather than like the trailer, which I also, there hasn't been an interesting trailer except for maybe the first one, this one, because it was such a punch in the nose. There hasn't been a good movie trailer that was like, you're going to want to see this movie without having to say those words in a very long time. So, a lot of the trailers, like, I'm expecting, like, the second trailer starting off with his Fear is a Tool monologue, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. We haven't really gotten to hear him speak as Batman yet, so that sounds cool. That's, like, a fresh dip into what, like, one aspect of this movie. And then, starting off the movie with that, like, everything I previously had experienced from the trailers, or even from, like, set imagery and all that, they're, you know, like, it's completely clean. Matt Reeves had filmed scenes at the funeral with Zoe Kravitz walking in with Falcone just to throw people off because yeah. those set images released. And we were like, oh, doesn't she look great as Selina Kyle? That's going to be awesome. This scene looks interesting. And she's not there. And I fucking love that because it shows such a mastery of like control over every aspect of the execution of the movie. You know, and that's happening, I think, a lot more now recently, whether it be through Disney being like, oops, we accidentally leaked something, or whether it be, you know, like Todd Phillips or Matt Reeves releasing purposeful screen tests, like the Joker screen test of just the camera and that song playing, and it's just Joaquin Phoenix standing there with the clown stuff, the clown projection. You remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And I remember being like right away being like, okay.
Well, that's like such a creative choice for a filmmaker to do, to put out like before anyone sees it. Or they did it for Birds of Prey too, with all of them in there, in like, you know, what would eventually become their evolved getup. And I think that's just super cool to see. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's people working in like, or at least working at Warner Brothers, because as much as people love to talk about how shitty Warner Brothers is with everything revolving the Zack Snyder cut of his movie, they are the majority. Warner Brothers and Universal are the majority letting directors do whatever the fuck they want. And yeah, there will be always producers saying, do this, do that, we have to fill something in here. But those are the two studios where it's like, big budget directors come here. We'll see how it is with Nolan going over to Universal, but that's basically what it is. And I think that's interesting where that creative shift is happening.
Yeah, because Warner Brothers has been the company that's been working with Nolan for the longest time, and Syncopy, like, they've been, you know, partnering with them. Yeah. So I didn't know that he's going over to Universal. We'll see. But they, yeah. They,
you know who got him to come over to Universal?
Who's that?
M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh, interesting. All right.
It's a, yeah. I mean, if you want to talk about someone just doing whatever the fuck they want for a movie, it's M. Night Shyamalan. And Universal is like, dude.
People still, yeah, people still give him carte blanche. They're just like, do whatever you want. And sometimes I think to his demise, I think he knows it too. Yeah. He's even said, as a filmmaker, he's been like, I need more people telling me, like, no. And I need more people, like, you know, reining me in sometimes. But okay. So this Batman movie, another aspect of it which is just, of course, is the people who are freaking out about, like, the wokeification of it, just because there happened to be, you know, three prominent characters that are people of color. And it's just sort of like, yeah, I guess we just can't have anybody that's like one of the main protagonists that isn't white. Otherwise it means it's woke.
Yeah.
And, but I, it's something that, like, I don't even think about when I'm watching the, like, all I thought about was, like, how good Jeffrey Wright was doing.
He's
and how
excellent as Gordon. Yeah. He's so fucking good. But I also got into a whole thing about, like, how stupid you have to be. One, there's anyone complaining about, like, woke in this movie, especially in regards to Selena Kyle acknowledging that rich white people do whatever the fuck they want with no consequences, you're acknowledging the reality of our fucking life. Of the idea that rich white people do whatever the fuck they want with no consequences. You have to acknowledge, like, hey, that's too much like what's going on. That's too woke. You know what I mean?
Right.
It makes no sense to go like she's talking about privileged white males, and that's too close to home because in real life, privileged white males do whatever they want. Let's not go woke. And it's like, oh, so then you're acknowledging.
I don't want that in my comic book movie, but it's also like, it's so Gotham City.
It's the most. It's the most Gotham since Tim Burton.
Yeah, taking down shitty rich white guys is what Batman does in Gotham City.
Yeah.
Like, that's what, and I mean, so this is a thing that we can get into about just the Batman character. So there's outside of just this movie that we've been talking about, the new movie. Like, what makes the character so compelling? And people have made this argument for a long time that, like, it's weird that we've been sold on the idea of rooting for people like Tony Stark and Bruce Wayne, because, like, it feels like we're being fed propaganda to think that billionaires are good people or that billionaires are heroes. I kind of think that it's actually the opposite of that. I think that it's like they're billionaires who behave the way we wish billionaires behave.
Oh yeah.
They're billionaires who, like, I mean, not that, like, I want Elon Musk or anybody to build a super suit and go around fighting crime or anything like that. It's that I wish that they viewed their enormous, unfathomable privilege as a call to action and as a calling to be that they now have to be. They have no choice other than to be an incredible person, that they have to utilize the amazing gift that they've been given, the enormous abundance of wealth that they've been gifted, for the ultimate good. And if they're not able to use their exorbitant wealth and power to help people and to affect real change in the world and not just further enrich themselves, if they're not able to do that, if they fall short of that, then they've failed massively at, like, taking care of this massive responsibility that's been given to them. So, like, when you meet Tony Stark in the Iron Man movies, as Robert Downey Jr. played him, for instance, it's like, yeah, he is kind of squandering the gift of his wealth and behaving the way that most billionaires behave. Sure, he probably donates several million dollars to different charities every year, but, like, in his personal life, he just sort of is sports cars and pinup models and doing whatever I want. And he has an experience that changes him and makes him realize that he needs to devote his life to doing everything he can to helping people. And that's the arc of that character over those movies. That's what makes it so powerful at the end of Endgame when we lose him, is that, like, he has spent the last half of his life being like kind of obsessively devoted to doing more and more and more for other people and feeling this pressure of the weight of the of like he's one of the only people in the world who has the ability to do it, so he feels like he has to, because if he doesn't do it, who else will? You know, and at least he has people like Steve, and you know. But
the funny thing about that to me is, it doesn't even have to be something as silly as making a metal suit. Like the whole point, like a constant point or like plot point for Tony Stark in all the Marvel movies is he's making New York City like the center of like clean energy or something. Like Stark Tower is the center of clean, reusable energy, and it's all self-sufficient and all that stuff. And that's like just, you know, a fantastical recreation of what we would want in the real world. And the idea of that there would be support behind something like that is obviously iffy, because in the real world, we all know that there's a good portion of people who are looking forward to Judgment Day, and they would never let, you know, the prolonged existence of humanity go that far. But,
yeah,
you know, like, it's impossible. And, well, there was that Cracked article that came out a while ago about, like, and at that time, it was an interesting idea. Like, why is Bruce Wayne going out and beating up mentally ill people? Why doesn't he use his fortune? And at the time, interesting idea. But at that point, it's like, all right, it's Brad, we got to make a movie. Which one do you want to watch? You want to watch billionaire Bruce Wayne going around being an aid to society through public function and all that stuff, or do you want to watch him go out and beat the shit out of crazy people? You know what I mean? There has to be a sense of like self-awareness behind that. And it's like, yeah, obviously if he could go around and just be like, hey, let's make better hospitals and schools and let's give all this money to orphanage, like that's the whole point behind.
Well, and that's, yeah, that's the real life version of it. When we talk about cinematic reality and when we talk about comic book reality, that's another one of those things that it's like, yeah, we don't actually want Richard Branson and
fucking Bloomberg
yeah, like we don't actually want these guys to like learn how to fight and go beat people up. We don't want that. It's the ideals of the characters that they're like that, and you really see this with this latest Batman movie where like, you know, when right off the bat, when Alfred's like, hey, you've got a meeting with the accountants or the shareholders. And he's like, I don't have time for that. And he's like, you have to do it. Otherwise, all your money will be gone. And he's like, I don't give a shit about the money, Alfred. He's like, the only thing the money is good for is helping me be better at being Batman. Like, and if Batman doesn't work, then I don't care what happens. I don't care if I lose all my money, I don't care if I die. Like, if I'm not able to help this city by being Batman, then I don't care. And in the cinematic reality of that world, and this is another thing too, when people talk about how dark and gritty Gotham City has gotten, that it seems like we just keep making it grittier and grosser and darker. It's like, well, we need to create a cinematic reality in which becoming Batman is a reasonable thing.
Yeah.
That like becoming Batman is the thing that someone is forced to resort to, where they're like, it's not just a handful of mentally ill people in my city. It's everybody. It's the high-ranking officials. Yeah. The corruption is rampant and it's the structural. Violence is rampant. And yeah, it's exactly. And it has to be met with force. It won't respond, you know. And that's the reality of this world. That's not really the reality of our world. And in our world, like, what we would like to see is people who have the incredible gift of exorbitant wealth and see them sort of have that kind of devotion to being like, if I'm not able to use my wealth to fix climate change, then what am I even doing?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not able to like personally fund and incentivize like clean energy projects and like and get people in all these different sectors of manufacturing to like change their processes to do things clean, then what am I even doing with all this wealth? Like, why do I even have it? I don't deserve it.
The funny thing enough is that like we're able to tell these stories where these characters have this sense of self-awareness surrounding themselves and their privilege. And in the real world, where we're creating those stories, some people don't have that sense of self-awareness. And it's like it's super ironic to think like, you know, everyone is seeing this movie. Everyone is experiencing, like, you know, this great story where political officials and structural, you know, structures of society in this city are so fucked in every way imaginable. And then we're like, oh, isn't that funny how, like, everything is so shit. Anyway, back to real world where everything is shit, but we're going to just continue to, you know, doing what we want.
Yeah. And it's that, you know, it's all that. That's the stuff that makes the character compelling. And then it's also what you said about just, like, what movie do you want to watch? Because it's also just, like, it's also just fucking cool. And yeah, that's just an aspect of, you know, it's kind of like in The Matrix where it's like, why does everyone dress that way when they go into The Matrix? Why is everyone's digital self-image cyberpunk?
Exactly.
Like, there's no one that just wants to wear, like, a hoodie. Like, nobody's like,
nobody
no,
deep down is that. Nobody deep down is like Mark Zuckerberg actually walking around in you know, Adidas flips and then in a hoodie. Everyone is in fucking leather and cool-ass sunglasses and slicked hair and...
That's who everyone wants to be when they go in. And it's just kind of like, why? And it's like, because it's cool.
Yeah.
Just because it looks cool. Like that's the only reason. And so there's also just that, because it's like, well, couldn't they find different ways of dealing with people in the Matrix other than Kung Fu? Like, since it's like a video game reality, couldn't they just sort of like, I don't know, like, just like very speedily run around people or something,
yeah,
or
just
like
hack something. I don't know. Yeah,
hack something. But it's like, no, it's just, it's cool.
You don't want to watch a bunch of like revolutionary kicks and flips, you know?
Yeah, it's just, it's cool. But, and so like there's that aspect of it too, where it's like, I think from the inception of the character and from the inception of characters like Batman and Superman, it's like, yes, they exist to be a representation of certain ideas and hope and standing up against certain things and bravery and courage. And, but also like there's an element of escapism to it where it's just like, could you imagine, you imagine if,
the perfect example of that goes back like to the 40s with fucking Captain America punching Hitler. I mean, it's like clear escapism, and it's clear, like, I don't want to think about, like, the structural ways to flip the system now, because one, it'll never happen, and two, it's not entertaining. You know, you want to think of a guy, you want to think of, and that, well, that's what's so great with having a character that's 80 years old, is you get to think of these interesting new ways to go, okay, well, how can we not exactly tell the same story, but tell a story in this history of a character in its own unique way. And Reeves did that so well. And I love that he co-wrote the script. And I think there's just something so special about when you have a filmmaker also put the hours into writing something, because then you can also, like, a lot of the times when a movie wins Best Picture, and if it's directed by some guy and it's written by some other guy and it's produced by a bunch of suits, the award goes to the guys in the suits, because they're the ones that made the movie. They're the ones that forked over the fucking cash for this movie. Mm-hmm. But when something like, you know, Tarantino or Paul Thomas Anderson or Barry Jenkins or someone goes out and they have a story that they create and then they put effort into visually creating that story as well, there's just more effort into saying, like, that is their movie. This is a brought to you by Tarantino or Alfred Hitchcock, or when you know, those guys that create the ground, like the little ground that the characters walk in the movie. And when they know the DNA of the characters, I think that's so much more special than any other version of it.
Yeah, it makes it much more of an auteur venture than just sort of a gig, which is what a lot of people who go and direct for Marvel, even if they're a great director like Chloe Zhao or you're operating in the Marvel framework, and Marvel will let you play only so much within the framework, but it's still like, cool, we got this great director to come do a Marvel movie, but like you gotta do a Marvel movie.
It's like, listen, we know how to make $1 billion. You mm-hmm. We can see how far you can go. I'm so terrified, but also kind of excited to see how it went with Sam Raimi and Doctor Strange, because if you're a creative studio and you want creativity to prosper, and you have a director who's so creatively distinct like Sam Raimi, making a movie that he got to co-write with the Loki writers about a character that he's so passionate about. Like, it's so funny to think about Sam Raimi, and, you know, he has that whole Doctor Strange joke in Spider-Man 2, and, like, he's a comic book nerd, you know what I mean? So he knows the character, he knows how to piece this story together. I'm so scared that, like, some part of it will be dampened, or I'm sure visually it'll be him, but I'm worried that, like, narratively something will go down, because it's like, one, when it comes to Marvel movies, they have to get you into the next one. You have to come back for the next one. So they automatically give your hit for like, hey, this was fun, right? Just wait till the next one. And I'm like, but I really like this one. Can I just sit with this one for a little bit? Nope, the story is continuing. You know what I mean? Whether it's like...
Well, it's a TV show.
Yeah.
And that's the real thing, is it's a TV show. So like when, you know, when you're watching a TV show and one of the episodes ends and it's like directed by Robin Wright and you're like, oh, Robin Wright directed that episode?
Exactly.
Cool.
That's exactly. But
it's like, but it's still like a TV, it's an episode of that show. It's not like you're like, whoa, this episode feels really different. You're like, oh, this is a good episode. And then it ends, you're like, oh, Robin Wright directed that episode. But like Robin Wright was brought in and she had to direct the episode within the framework of that show.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't be like, I wonder if the show is more like this. It's like, no, like it's the show. And she can make some choices about like how she wants to represent certain moments visually or talk with the actors about certain things. But like you've got to operate within the framework. And that's what Marvel is. It's a very expensive...
You've seen Eternals, right?
Yeah.
Did you hear Chloe Zhao talk about the original ending she had in mind?
No.
She said, oh, spoiler for Eternals. I don't know. It's been out since November. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm always worried when it comes to spoilers because people fucking complain so much. She said the original ending for Eternals was they fail. They fail and, I mean, they succeed as far as like stopping Earth from turning into a celestial, but they fail in the grand scheme in that they get their minds erased and they're just sent to another planet in another solar system. And the last shot of the movie is them from the beginning, basically like longingly looking forward to like prospering on another planet. And she said, they were like, no, we can't do that. We have to sell the next movie. So what you have to do is bring in, what's his face from the band. What's that boy band? Five.
Oh yeah. Harry Styles.
Bring in Harry Styles. He's going to play a character that three people who were alive in the '70s will know. And everyone else will love because it's Harry Styles. And that'll sell the next movie. And she was like, all right, well, I mean, you know, I don't get final say when it comes to this. So, of course, you know, we're going to do it that as best as we can. And, you know, that's just the way it is. It's I like a comic issue, you know, like that's the special thing about to me and to everyone else is that Marvel is very much like, you know, you get a comic mailed to you every month. And it's leading to a final story. And then that final story comes in 10 years and you have a good time. That's very much what it feels like. Whereas when I'm watching, you know, something like I, it's so funny how willing I am to sacrifice continuity because all I want is something just of like piping hot quality, like just slaved over by people who know what they're doing, who know their craft, who aren't thinking about what comes next. And it's like, here's something fucking great. Enjoy it for now and for forever. And if we make another one, don't get your hopes up because that was not in the cards in the first place.
Yeah. Yep. Me too. And that's what's, I mean, so when people even like, when people compare, you know, Robert Pattinson to, oh, well, there's no way he could take on Batfleck, like Ben Affleck. So or comparing them, the movies saying like my Batman will always be Michael Keaton, you know, or something like that. I'm like, they're intentionally different.
Yeah.
They're not meant to be the same.
Yeah.
They're meant to be different visions of the same character, but they're intentionally different. Like you don't act. I mean, I had the same problem with when, you know, like when Man of Steel came out and people were like, this is not Richard Donner. Like this is not Superman. And it's like, yeah, no, it is Superman. And it's very intentionally not the Richard Donner Superman. It's a different version of Superman, but it's still Superman. It's still very much so. Superman, like he feels like Superman, he sounds like Superman, he looks like Superman, and it's a little darker and it's a little bit more rooted in a universe where like consequences are a little bit more of a thing, maybe a little more humorless, but like it's still Superman, and I like that about DC that like I get to see different filmmakers. And I feel like as Batman fans, we have been so spoiled with just such a cool smattering of different takes on the character. And I love how different Bale is from Affleck, from Pattinson. Like in this century, we have had really, really cool takes on those characters. And then to even like to throw in the Joker into the mix. And all of a sudden there's this character where it's like, It's wild that two actors have won Academy Awards for playing the same character, and it's a fucking comic book. It's a comic book villain from a comic book called Batman.
And the only time that has ever happened in history is with two of the greatest films of all time. The Godfather and Godfather Part Two. It's like it, and that just shows the universal effect of when you hop that genre line and you're like, hey, this is something that can, I don't want to say comic book movies can't be taken seriously, but there's a level of like, oh, hey, look, there's a flying guy. I'm not going to really invest much of myself into this movie. But when it's something that we can all watch that just feels like more, I don't really know how to explain. Like the only movies for me that have ever felt like more were The Dark Knight, Logan, and now The Joker, and now this.
Yeah. Totally. No, I would agree with that. The Dark Knight, Logan,
and even in a Joker. Fantastic movie. Like people, when I say that now, people get upset. Like you're not going to put, like, never mind. You know, the irrational like Infinity War and Endgame arguments, because those are entertaining as fuck. But what I'm talking about, like, it's weird to say quality objectively, but I genuinely mean quality objectively. Like I think of The Winter Soldier. I think that's the best film of the MCU. I think that's the best one where I'm like, I'm going in because one, interesting story, two, fantastic performances, three, it's a story that has not been told yet. It's a mystery. It's got, you know, a whole sense of political things going on in that movie. And it's not a coincidence that's the Russo Bros' first time directing with Marvel. And then after that, their stuff becomes much more congealed into that same kind of mold of like everyone's quipping all the time and it's awesome action. You know what I mean?
Yeah. For sure. But yeah, I agree with your assessment that it so rarely happens that films sort of jump the genre and become like something more where you're, and honestly, my assessment of the movie Joker, is that like, As I've watched it more since it left the theaters,
mm-hmm.
I've watched it a couple times, and I almost feel like the comic book element of it is the thing that holds the movie back. That it's sort of like it feels like this amazing character study, but you're constantly reminded that like we're in Gotham City right now, and this guy is on his way to becoming the Joker.
Yeah.
And that aspect of it is so, but it's also
it's
really
got a
fun.
Pinky. It's got a pinky it's over also, the line.
Yeah, and that's all, but that's also like really fun that you're like, I mean, it's sort of like that a movie that I thought had a great concept and just like not excellent execution was that, I can't remember what the name of it was. It was that movie that was like the horror film of Superman, where
Brightburn.
It was sort of Redburn. Yeah, Brightburn. And I thought that concept was so great, but it was a thing where I was like, you know what I would have, and again, trailers. I wish that trailers didn't do what they did, because I thought, how cool would it have been if that movie didn't tell people that it was evil Superman? If the trailer was just
sell
like, there's something wrong with this kid. There's something, like something's wrong with our son. Our son is acting weird, and it looks like a demonic possession
movie.
Sell it
as a paranormal, satanic type thing.
Yeah, you know, and then people go see it, and they're like telling their friends, they're like, you have to go see Brightburn. Mm-hmm. And they're like, why? They're like, there's a twist in it that is
you'll never see
fucking phenomenal. Like it's
that's great.
And some people might be like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. But like, I think it's sort of like a Cabin in the Woods thing where it's like, don't tell anyone in the trailer what
don't
it is.
Don't tell anyone
like,
how like, grand it, the scale is.
Yeah. It's teenagers going to a cabin in the woods and like some scary stuff happens. You know the movie and you're like, oh, yeah. I think, but the problem with
and then
that
as
movie
you're watching,
is
you're just like,
this is something else. This is something else.
Yeah.
And I think that how cool would it have been if they just didn't tell you and then you're watching going, is this Superman? This is Superman. But it's
great.
If Superman was evil.
That'd
and
be
like
so
that
good.
Like just so cool. Yeah. When he finally puts on the cape, you'd be like, oh my God. Because that question of like, and that's what makes Superman such a compelling character, and again what makes Batman such a compelling character is it's the Spider-Man line, with great power comes great responsibility. But Superman has this thing where it's like, if you're not the best person, if you are not just like have a golden soul and a golden heart, you will be corrupted so quickly by the amount of power that you wield, because you could be supreme emperor of Earth for as long as you want. You could have anything you want. You could have all the money, all the power, all that you could You could decimate every world, every country's military in seconds. And the fact that you don't, the fact that you hold back, and the fact that you like you choose instead to operate for good is so impressive. And that's what makes the character so compelling, is like his humanity.
Exactly.
The fact that he was, you know, that and what the Kents instilled into him values-wise. And it's the same way with Batman and Tony Stark, where it's like you have more power than most people on Earth. Like you have more ability and not just money, but like you're probably smarter than 99% of people on the planet. And also like physically gifted. Like you've just got a package. Like you've just been given such a package. And if you're not a great person, you're going to become a total asshole. You're going to become a bad person.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting, to see those characters like striving to make the most of what they've been given, striving to do the most possible with it.
That's when you get the most compelling stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, with that is like the suspension of disbelief, where like we just have to go with Robert Pattinson and with Christian Bale's Batman, that it's like, I guess they don't kill people. Yeah. I guess they don't.
Yeah.
Because when I'm watching, I'm like, you're killing people all over the place, my guy. But like when you're holding a guy's face up against a pole and you're tasing his neck.
Yeah.
Part of me is like,
and then there's a little guy in the back of my head going, oh, he worked out the voltage so he doesn't kill them. You know what I mean? Like he worked out the exact megahertz he needs, you know?
But the car chase scene, I'm like, those people are dead. Those people are dead.
Dude, like, hold on.
Oh, look at that. Oh, how sick.
I got into Legos for 1 second, and this is the only one I got. No, I got the Infinity Gauntlet back there too, but this is something else.
That's amazing. Yeah. But that's it. That sequence, it's like, yeah, like you probably killed like 12 people to get to a guy that didn't even wind up being the But Christian Bale's Batman does it too. He rides around in his car blowing up like parked cars, just like shooting at them.
Yeah,
it's like
even
if there's not a person in that, that's someone's car.
Someone like, do you know Legal Eagle on YouTube?
No.
He's this lawyer that goes around and like, you know, I don't know how real lawyers have the time to do this, but he talks about like lawyer stuff in movies and TV, and he does all the crimes that happen throughout the Dark Knight trilogy, and the amount of like property damage is insane. Let alone insane. Like being a vigilante and how illegal that is instantly, but like the level of like explosions and cars that the tumbler goes over and highways that have to be like repaved.
Rebuilt it's highway. It's like he's trying to help this city that he loves, and he's also like one of the things that's like actively destroying the infrastructure. He's like blowing it half to shit every time he goes out. But that's one of the aspects of it where you just go, it makes the movie cool, and it's like like you said, which movie do you want to watch? Do you want to watch Bruce Wayne going around and funding a bunch of projects to build better roads and to like and. Or do you want to watch him getting in car chases with the police and ramming through like highway barriers in the tumbler and stuff? And it's like, yeah, you want to watch that movie because it's dope, you know? And so the again, set your expectations. Like if you're watching Jurassic Park, just
gonna see dinosaurs. A fucking dinosaur.
There's dinosaurs. There's the, you know, if you're watching Titanic, it's on a boat. Like it's not cars, it's a boat, you know, and it just. Have the right expectations for what movie you're watching. I just want to talk a little bit more while I still got you. I think we'll bring it down here, but I think just about the other films. So, like I said, we've been very spoiled as Batman fans, and we've had so much good stuff and interesting stuff and interesting takes on these different characters in this universe, especially in the last 20 years. But going through the 90s, like those first four films, like which they are connected because the same guy plays Alfred in all four of them. It's easy to think there's the Tim Burton movies and then there's the Joel Schumacher movies, but like they're in ish the same universe, which I actually think it hurts the Joel Schumacher movies that they try to connect them.
Yeah, just
to the
be
other
your
films,
own thing,
I'm
man.
Like, I'm like, because it's very clear that Joel Schumacher has no interest in picking up where Burton left off, and like he wants to do his own thing.
Well, and it's kind of like what's so interesting to me is people act like this whole fucking thing with Zack Snyder is new. Like, did you see what? Like, the only reason why it's particularly shitty with the Zack Snyder thing is because like he had a family tragedy and all and yada yada. And I don't know why he's somehow one of the most like polarizing directors of the last decade, but he's become that. Like through no, you know, will of his own. He's just, you know, there's enough people to, who have associative producer of the Snyder Cut in their fucking Twitter bio to make him that guy, even though I can think of more directors that probably put more of an imprint in filmmaking. But we talked about Richard Donner. He got screwed over with his movies, and the Donner Cut was a thing. And we want to talk about the reaction to Batman Returns and how so many like parents and people were like, my kid couldn't see this movie. My kid went to see this movie, and Danny DeVito scared him because a good portion of Batman Returns is fairly, you know, scary and truly traumatizing.
It's one of the most, like unsettling, disgusting characters to ever be on screen in
and
a comic book movie.
The reaction to that, what do we get from like the social reaction of like, I didn't like this, it should be more joyful and silly, is we get like neon fucking Gotham and bat credit card and bat nipples, and it's like, all right, you know what? At this point, I'm not that guy to keep shitting on those movies. They are what they are. They're for children.
Uh-huh.
It's fine. I can show this to a child, and I won't have to worry about him like thinking of it at late at night and giving them nightmares. And that's
what
it is.
I was a kid, and I liked Batman Forever. I had so much fun with it, and I thought Jim Carrey was great because I was a little kid, and yeah. In the 90s, and Jim Carrey was everything. Jim Carrey was Elvis, and if Jim Carrey was in a movie, I was seeing it, so I loved Batman Forever. But even as a kid, I couldn't do Batman and Robin. Even as a little kid, I was like, all right, I think I'm out on this one. I don't, you know.
That's what happens, yeah. So you have this entire recall of, like, the vibe, and everyone wonders why, like, wait, these are connected? It makes no sense. Like, and not to mention, you have Billy Dee Williams, who's Harvey Dent, and then Tommy Lee Jones comes in, and it's like the only thing they couldn't end up doing was saying like this is completely different from over there. So we have this string of movies that nearly killed the fucking character, and then Christopher Nolan comes in and he goes, listen, I'm going to do this version of the story of a different story and have it be a new origin, and it revives the character. It literally makes the character box office like possible again. Mm-hmm. Because of how badly it was destroyed in 97.
Not only just the character, but the Christopher Nolan movies kind of revitalize comic book films in general,
mm-hmm.
kind of make people think of films as that they can be more. And I think Christopher Nolan's I think Batman Begins influences the first Iron Man movie too. I think it like
100%.
I think it brings to the forefront this idea that like we can take these a little bit more seriously and people will go with us. People
well,
will
also
suspend
because
their disbelief and
at the same time, you have, I mean, this is not talking about the quality of these movies, but at the same time, you have Spider-Man trilogy happening. You have the X-Men trilogy basically ending, I think, at around the same time. And you have, you know, Fantastic Four. And you have these movies that are like, oh, that's a comic book movie. And then you have a Batman movie that's like, that's a fucking, did you guys see that movie? You know what I mean? It just completely splits the highway instantly.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember seeing the trailers. I remember the trailer for Batman Begins and like thinking, like, this looks different. This looks, you know, and then I went and saw that movie for the first time with friends at a drive-in movie theater. And I was like, yeah, that was like a real movie. That was, mm-hmm. you know, one thing I noticed right off the bat with Batman Begins, and it's in all of Christopher Nolan's movies. And it's like, it's a testament to how good the movies are because I don't mind it enough to like, not like the movies is I remember the criticism I had leaving the theater after seeing Batman Begins was I was like, it's hard to tell what's going on in the fight scenes. Like, everything's very shaky, and you can't really tell what's going on. Yeah. And that just turns out to be sort of the way that Christopher Nolan shoots fight scenes in movies, is it's, like, kind of hard to tell what's going on. I thought he did a really nice job in Tenet with the way that those fight scenes were shot, particularly the one that is moving in reverse with...
Well, you kind of hope that over time, like, there's part of you watching, like, some fight scenes in The Dark Knight Rises, and you're like, oh, okay, we kind of see where he's not a master at. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like his goal as a filmmaker was to make the fight scenes look the way that it would look if you were a person
watching
seeing
them.
Batman.
Yeah.
And that Batman would kind of swoop through and move so quickly and move so stealthily that it was hard to tell what's going on. That he moves with such, like... But with what you do catch in the frame, it always just looks like Christian Bale is just sort of elbowing people.
Yeah, it's a lot of
lots of elbows and but in that first movie especially, it's like he's just sort of moving like a blur, mm-hmm. and you're not really seeing what he, like when he says, "I can't fight three of your pawns," mm-hmm. and then he drops down, "Have it your way," and drops down a few more. You don't really see what happens. You just sort of see him just sort of tussling with guys, and it's hard to kind of get a view of like what's actually happening in the fight choreography. And that's sort of present throughout the trilogy. But the movies are still good enough that you're not like, the fight scenes were bad, so I didn't like the movie.
It becomes that thing that everyone is like, oh, Nolan, yeah. The guy, his action scenes are a little muddy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then what comes next is a guy who I think primarily should only be making action scenes.
Yeah.
With Zack Snyder.
Zack Snyder, you mean? Yeah,
he
exactly.
creates one of the best action scenes with Batman ever, is that warehouse scene.
Ever. And it's a scene where in the narrative of the film, it doesn't make a lot of sense because it's kind of like, wait, Clark can't just go grab her? Bruce has to go get her? Clark is so fast that like he's maybe faster than the Flash. He can't just like go over there and get her and mm-hmm. just be like, I'm just going to grab my mom and but it's like, whatever. Bruce has to go get her. But it creates one of the coolest scenes that Batman's ever been in on camera. Until I think this club scene might rival it in the Batman. I think the club scene.
Well, there are so many. Oh, you know what's so great about that club scene is one. He's got this. Well, I mean, also perfect example to compare is we have one Batman that kicks through the window and does a whole thing with an excellent like array of gadgets. He turns off all the guns, which is something you want to think about. Like Batman has to handle like 13 guys at once. He can't deal with all of them to deal with the gun, so he does the whole thing. He takes one of them, and it's so much more dynamic of a fight scene. And in this one, it's very much like he's making a statement. He's walking through the club. That runway is so great, and you see
the
aesthetic
change.
Yeah,
he wants everyone to see him.
Yeah.
That he's not afraid of anybody, mm-hmm. and like it's an announcement to the people at this club, like, you've heard of me, here I am. And you know, and so when Oswald walks up, he's like, wow, you really are everything they say you are, aren't you? Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, you just watch me fucking kick the shit out of
like
15
a bullet
of
through
your guys.
An aluminum bat at a guy's face. How Kenzie didn't he got up with a broken nose is like, hey man, you should go play the lottery.
yeah exactly. But yeah, I think, you know, Zack Snyder, it's interesting the trajectory of Zack Snyder's filmmaking career, because initially it seemed like a lot of people, there were like nothing but like vitriolic Zack Snyder haters. Like when he made Man of Steel and then Batman vs. Superman, people were like, Zack Snyder sucks. Zack Snyder's a really shitty filmmaker.
And then what happens
and
when
then
the pendulum swings one way?
Counter movement to being like, he's the best filmmaker in the world. I'm like, he's neither of those things. He's exactly what you said. He's fantastic at action sequences. He should be a DP. He should be like a very well-known cinematographer.
Yeah.
He should be like shooting movies for other directors and coming up with like amazing shot ideas and storyboards.
Which is why, I mean, so like he's doing his whole space opera, which was supposed to be a Star Wars movie, and they were like, no thanks, we know how to make billion-dollar Star Wars movies, and we also don't want the name of Zack Snyder. And Netflix was like, here's a bunch of money, do whatever the fuck you want. I think he just confirmed like the other day that he's also going to be the DP of that too. He was the DP for Army of the Dead over last summer, and he's going to do it for this too. And I think that that shows a sense of like, one, he's got to like, My favorite thing about Zack Snyder, and I met him, I sort of stalked him on that fucking social media app Vero, you know, that no one else uses but him. And I met him and I was like, listen, like you're a creative inspiration in filmmaking. Like I can think of all his films, and the one thing that I always piece away from the film, whether I enjoy it or not, is that idea of like this guy, like he's I can picture like all of this was in his head. And he got it out in a way that wasn't boring, that wasn't muddy or you know, bogged down by any type of like structural issue. You know what I mean? And I think that's my favorite aspect of it. And so when you have someone like him stretch his muscles and be like, all right, here we go, like prepare for it like this, I think it's something that's really special. And when it comes to the other qualities of his filmmaking, I think he excels at some things, and there are some things that he just... I think that it's not a coincidence that of his DC movies, Man of Steel is the one that I frequently rewatch more than anything. Is one because Christopher Nolan was involved, Chris Terrio was involved more than anything, and I think that's just a more cohesive script, a more cohesive type of film. And one, I mean, like, God, who doesn't want to think about 2013? You know what I mean? And be like, yeah, I remember seeing this in theaters, and I remember having a good time, and being like, hey, it's a Superman movie. The last Superman movie was with Brendan Routh, and I didn't like that one bit because that was pretty boring, and he fights an island in the end of it. This one is a bunch of destruction, and that's kind of like his little insert into the genre, you know?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that movie, and I love what Hans Zimmer did with the score, and I felt like Henry Cavill was like inspired casting. It was just sort of like, oh, that guy that guy's Superman. I'm a big apologist for that movie. A lot of people have a lot of problems with that movie, but I'm like, I think it's a really solid movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like Watchmen, and I really, you know.
Oh yeah. Well, I've said like completely regardless of quality or structural quality or objectively, Watchmen is my quintessential comic book movie. When I think of like a graphic novel put to screen, even though he changes the ending cinematically for the better. It is the peak of like, I feel like I'm in a graphic novel right now. And the reason why I think that the Batman diverges from that list is that it hops that genre border. I think that it would be right there with it for me if it didn't have those elements of like political critique and mystery and stuff like that.
The thing about the Batman is, if you had never seen another Batman movie ever, if you had never heard of the character of the Batman, and that movie came out and you watched it, you would be so compelled by it. You would be like, this is so interesting.
It has the benefit and curse of following 80 years of the character.
Yeah. But it works. Just the way that they deal with him, like showing the way that the police look at him, and they're just like, who the hell? Because he looks crazy.
Yeah.
He looks like an insane person. So when people talk about, why does Bruce Wayne go around beating up mentally ill people? It's like, well, Bruce Wayne is mentally ill. Like he's, look what he's wearing. Like, he looks crazy. And if you're a normal person, if you're a cop and a detective at a crime scene, and that guy walks in, you're like, what the hell is this guy doing here? Mm-hmm. Why is this guy here? Why is he dressed like that? Like, get him out of here. And then your cop friend is like, hey, I've been talking with this guy. He's pretty smart. Like, he's actually, like, pretty cool. But, like, he's weird. He's really weird. And it's just, it's compelling, you know? I think what Matt Reeves offers also is, like, it's sort of blending the grasp on, you know, groundedness and grittiness that Nolan has, and like character and visual storytelling, and then also bringing in the knack for very visually pleasing action sequences as well that you get from Snyder, where he prefers to, and it doesn't look like a Zack Snyder action sequence, but I like that Matt Reeves keeps the camera wide and lets you see what's happening.
You see the full movements, and he also has the benefit of, like, you know, 15 years of like an infinitely better, like, constructed suit. Like, he talks about how comfortable it was, which no other Batman has ever said, like, I loved having it on, you know what I mean? And I think that that definitely helps. But there's also what was I just gonna say? There's something super hyper real, as much as, like, you know, Reeves talks about how grounded this Batman is, and it is, there's a sense of like, if someone were to have the resources, they could do this. Yes. There's such a sense of hyper-realism to everything that I think it kind of puts it just in between, like, BVS and the Dark Knight trilogy. Because in the Dark Knight trilogy, I'm like, oh, so this is our world. This is a billionaire who found a military tactical suit and puts it on and goes and fights, you know, people who are trying to poison the water supply. And in the Batman, it's like, this is a world where, like, this is the most Gotham City it's ever been since, like, the very character-driven Gotham of Batman in 1989.
Yes.
Like, Tim Burton is so Tim Burton that the city is Tim Burton. And in this one, Matt Reeves figured out a way to make the city its own thing, to make the city feel like it's fucking breathing.
Yeah, because Chris Nolan's Gotham City is Chicago. It's just Chicago.
The one where he tries the most to make it like you know, we have the slums in Batman Begins, and then he goes into the city, and that's the most where it's like, oh, so this is, you know, I can look at the map of Gotham, like, all right, so this is where the you know, the people who live below the poverty line are, and this is where the skyscrapers are. And then after that, in like The Dark Knight, it's like, oh yeah, no, we're just gonna do Chicago. And that's fine, you know, because Chicago is that kind of city where it's like, it's got, you know, it's got those low, you know, areas, and it has those skyscraper areas where you can set something fantastical but still keep it grounded. And in this one, it's like, this is a Gotham City that we're kept mostly on the ground of. And we have those shots of him on the motorcycle driving through, but we are third person over his shoulder seeing this city firsthand. And I think that's what separates it from everything.
We don't ever really get to see Zack Snyder's Gotham City. You were in it for a few scenes in Justice League and BVS, but like, you don't really get to like see like what the city, what the architecture really looks like, what the, you know. And I think, you know, that but yeah, this really feels like for the first time since Tim Burton, where Gotham City has really been fleshed out as a character in the film as well. So it feels in many ways like it has a lot of the best aspects of all of the best iterations on screen that Batman has had. And then it's also its own thing in that, like,
what I mean by, like, literally something else. It has the benefit of learning from, you know, it's so interesting to think, like, you know, before Batman Begins, it was like, all right, there was, you know, that's 2005, I think. And then, like, you know, 8 years ago, 8 years before that was like, you know, that string of Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher. And then fucking 30 years before that was Adam West. So, like, the saturation is coming down to a fine point. You know what I mean? Like, it's gone from so wide to, like, now we're, like, within the last 10 years, we've had, you know, literally 10 years, exactly. We've had three Batman, which is fucking insane to me.
Yeah.
It's really crazy. And as much as, like, you know, I love when stories of other characters that have never been seen visually on screen ever happen, there's a unique quirk to seeing a character like this evolve cinematically in so many different ways. And one, because you have these filmmakers that need to figure something out. They need to figure out how to distinct it. And two, they also have to not completely just shun 80 years of history.
Yeah. And I'm okay with filmmakers doing that, and with movie companies doing that. People who get, like, so bummed out about, like, Hollywood has no original ideas, or, like, how come everything's a remake? I'm like, hey, look, This is just storytelling. Like, we've been telling the same stories since the dawn of civilization.
Nothing is original. Nothing.
Yeah, we've been telling retreads, and so, like, I'm okay with different filmmakers saying, I'd like to take my crack at this character that's very popular.
Because that's all anything ever is.
And explore a different level of it, or a different layer of it. So that's why I'm really into, you know, Todd Phillips doing that look at Joker and going, let's not even worry about, like, how the timeline lines up, that if the Joker is, like, a 45-year-old man and Bruce Wayne is 10, how old is the Joker when Bruce Wayne is, like, 25? Is he, like, you know, let's not worry about that.
That's,
like,
elder abuse at that point.
Yeah. You know, it's a different universe and different rules. And
I've also, like, more, at this point, I've mastered that, especially with DC movies, because I'm so, like, the people that are like, we need to have a connected cinematic universe. I'm like, hey, man, you need that. I'm totally fine with 1,000 different stories that have nothing the fuck to do with each other, because I would rather that than, like, Superman walking in, you only see from his fucking nipples down. I don't give a shit at that point, because I know that's not Henry Cavill. So it's not connected to me. That is its own wholesome ass Shazam movie. Then you have Joker being fucking, you know, intensely cinematic in that theatrical way, and then you have Batman, and then you have all these other things, and that's all I want, is that creative fucking dispersion, rather than, like, hey, but at least they're all connected, right? They're boring as shit and I can only watch 3 out of the 15 of them, but at least they're all connected.
Yeah.
I'm so tired of that.
Yeah. I think we're going to wrap it up because I think we could keep talking about this forever. And I think we, you know, like covered the new movie and talked about the others and talked about the character. And I think we talked about all the things that I wanted to talk about. Hey, where can people follow you on social media and keep up with what you're doing with movies and stuff?
You can follow me on Instagram at Comedian of Cinema. You can follow me on Twitter, which, you know, on Instagram has links to everything. Like on my YouTube channel, Comedian of Cinema, I have my podcast, How's It Going to End, where I talk. I have an episode with Austin up there, and I talk with people. And I'm trying not to make it me talking about myself because I don't think anyone cares about that. So I'm trying my hardest to like get people possibly interested in. Like recently, I talked with BJ McDonald, the director of Studio 666, the Foo Fighters movie that came out, and he has so many interesting insights, the practical effects, and that kind of stuff. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Amazing, Tim, thanks so much for coming back on the show and talking.
Thanks for having me, man.
About these movies. This was a lot of fun, and for being a part of the first video edition of People Pleaser. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. The show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. You can go to themarmalademusic.com and tell Chris that you heard his work over here, and he'll do your first audio project for 20% off. So go link up with Chris to do that. Okay, patreon.com/AustinArcher if you want to support the show. I think, yeah, we're good. All right. Thanks for being here. Go see Batman if you haven't seen it already. I hope you didn't listen to this or watch this without seeing it. And maybe I'll go watch it again tonight or sometime this week. See you later, everybody, and Comedian of Cinema in on the East Coast. We the people pleasers, fancy.